This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If you would like to have your heart broken, just come out here. This is the dust storm country. It is the saddest land I have ever seen. They say that in 20 years, our farmland is going to be pretty well shot unless something is done. And that in 75 years, even a self-respecting cactus wouldn't be seen on most of it. Ernie Pyle.
Progress, far from consisting in change, depends on retentiveness. When change is absolute, there remains no being to improve and no direction is set for possible improvement. And when experience is not retained, infancy is perpetual. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. That was philosopher George Santayana, writing in 1906, 30 years before the peak of the American Dust Bowl, a chapter of the 20th century that's often called America's worst man-made ecological disaster. So far, anyway. A lengthy dry spell, combined with farming practices that did not respect the natural conditions of the region, set into motion a decade which devastated millions of acres of land, displaced thousands of heartland families, and had ripple effects on food markets and the national economy. Documentary filmmaker Ken Burns has produced a new film series on the Dust Bowl. It features survivors, experts on climate and farming, as well as some amazing footage from the era. He's my guest today on Sea Change Radio. We discuss this important project, which is being released against the ominous backdrop of our current drought conditions. In 2012, North America has seen a record low snowfall and a corresponding decline in rain. And the U.S. Drought Monitor shows that about 80% of the country to be suffering abnormally dry conditions, with over 60% of the country already in full-fledged drought. Are there lessons from the Dust Bowl that will inform how we move forward as a nation through the impending hardship of continued drought? Ken Burns' latest project is well-timed and ought to help in our efforts to remember the past and escape the condemnation of repeating our mistakes. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by filmmaker Ken Burns. His latest film is The Dust Bowl. It premieres on PBS November 18th and 19th. Ken, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
So what inspired you to do this piece?
Well, I think there's just a sense that there's a conventional wisdom about the Dust Bowl that many of us have, that it's like grapes of wrath, or that it's a picture of a migrant farm mother that Dorothea Lange took. It's some image of the storms. And I think people forget that this was the worst man-made ecological disaster in all of American history and perhaps world history so far, that this was a 10-year apocalypse that nearly destroyed a whole area of the Southern Plains during the Great Depression. So it was like hurt squared. And we realized that in order to tell the story, we wanted to get people who'd lived through it, and that those people had mostly died off, and some of their children and folks who were teenagers at that time were still around. And we quickly mobilized and through a great deal of effort and research and sort of detective work, tracked down more than 24 survivors of the Dust Bowl who were kids or teenagers at the time, and were able to get them to tell their story and have a real oral history of this cataclysmic time.
And is that one of the instigators of beginning this process, is that these people may not be living that much longer? We need to really get a historical document in a more vibrant way.
I've done a lot of films about long ago past events in which there are no survivors. I made a film on the Civil War and nobody is living, and you can do it. I made a film on Lewis and Clark and they've been long gone. But there was something about the possibility that these folks in their late 80s and 90s, but children back then, would be a key to understanding just how terrible this was, but also what a personal story of heroic perseverance. These folks withstood this 10-year hundreds of storms that would left nothing untouched. It destroyed the crops, it destroyed the cattle, it destroyed their children. You couldn't, if a storm went by, even if your house was completely locked up, all the windows sealed, your house would be filled with dust. They're clean in the morning. In the afternoon, you could draw your name in a plate on your table. You could draw a picture, and we have footage of people drawing a picture of a house on the dirt that had just accumulated in a few hours on their dining room table.
As far as Washington, D.C., after Black Sunday, it sounded like. Maybe walk back and tell some of our listeners what Black Sunday was first.
Well, Black Sunday was the worst of all the storms. On April 14th, 1935, only halfway through this 10-year apocalypse, and it just caught people unaware. The day had started off very nicely, and the storm was so ferocious, it was so large, that most of the folks would say, you know, this is the end of the world. In fact, we found some old recording of an itinerant, then 22-year-old songwriter and musician who found himself in Pampa, Texas, caught with a lot of people who were certain that Black Sunday was the end of the world. And he sat down and wrote a song called So Long It's Been Good to Know You. His name is Woody Guthrie, and he's one of the most famous musicians. And it will always be associated with the Dust Bowl because he sang the anthems of the Dust Bowl and the songs that tried to make the reality of it happen. In fact, he wrote a song after that about that particular Black Sunday. But other storms carried the dirt even farther, and it was amazing. They go all the way east, that Franklin Roosevelt could wipe his finger across the top of his desk in the Oval Office and come up with Oklahoma or Texas on the fingertips. Ships out in the Atlantic, 300 miles out in the Atlantic, would be covered with a patina of dust. I mean, these were extraordinary events. One storm, and remember, there are hundreds of storms a year for 10 years. One storm moved more dirt, rearranged more landscape than the entire 10-year process that it took us to build the Panama Canal. So we're talking about a force of nature so great and so out of whack because this grasslands had been turned over into farmland and should not have been, that we ended up with this great man-made ecological catastrophe.
We want it now. And if it makes money now, it's a good idea, but it isn't necessarily it's a good idea. If the things we're doing are going to mess up the future, it wasn't a good idea. Don't deal on the moment. Take the long-term look at things.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to filmmaker Ken Burns. Ken, you're known for meticulous research on some of our nation's most interesting historical events or eras, from baseball and jazz to the Civil War and the war. The Dust Bowl struck me as unique in that you must have had to do some very meticulous research into meteorological history. Can you shed a little light on that process and how it may have informed you and your colleagues into what's happening now to our planet?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I can't really honestly say. We did do a lot of meticulous research in finding the photographs of the evidence of the Dust Bowl. We did try to learn how they were formed and the certain meteorological conditions that were present. Essentially, the equation is pretty simple. The wind blows half the time pretty ferociously in the southern plains. If you turn over the dirt and there's nothing left to hold the dirt because there's a drought, that dirt will blow. And it'll blow into your neighbor's farm, and it'll blow into the next county, and it'll blow into the next state. That's basically about the sum of it. But I think we realize, as we have many fragile ecosystems today, some of them on the verge of the collapse, like our oceans, that we have a responsibility. We have to have a kind of humility, as the writer Tim Egan says about Mother Nature, that we respect the land, that we learn new techniques of how to deal with it, how to yield its bounty without destroying its great resource. We have to learn how to have our agriculture and many of our other practices be sustainable, because we're fairly soon going to have an unlivable planet, and a planet that's run out of fish, a planet that's run out of enough arable land to feed the rest of us, that will be in great dangers unless we plan for the long term. And one of the sad lessons of the Dust Bowl is that you get to see yet another era where people didn't plan for the long term, where it was all about what was going to happen now. And if this crop failed, then they were what was called next year people, meaning it'll be better next year. But this got so ferocious, it the dust pneumonia that killed their children got so prevalent that many of them just picked up and left and tried to make a go of it somewhere else. And a lot of its lessons were not learned. Many were retained about correct plowing techniques and rotation of crops, and the government did buy back some farmland and return it to grasslands and did pay farmers not to plant. But the net effect is that we figured out how to drill down into the Ogallala Aquifer and brought up this expensive water to wet down that dirt and grow the crops, and not just the easy-to-grow wheat, but the very hard-to-grow, requiring a lot of water, feed corn. And we're depleting that Ogallala Aquifer. It's not a sustainable resource. We're mining that water. It's just leftover water from the last ice age. And when it's gone, it might be that we'll be faced with another terrific dust bowl, and that the danger that they worried back in the 1930s, that a huge portion of the landscape would turn into an American Sahara Desert.
I've sung this song, but I'll sing it again, of the place that I lived on the wild, windy plains in the month called April, county called Gray, and here's what all of the people there say. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is getting my home, and I've got to be drifting along.
And I remember us digging down, and the earth was moist down there. It was beautiful soil. It was beautiful soil.
Well, nature took several million years to find a solution to these unstable soils, these high winds, these turbulent weather conditions, which was the grasses. They are an evolutionary adaptation. They work pretty well for the most part. They have survived here for millions of years. Our agriculture hasn't been here for much more than a century.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with filmmaker Ken Burns. His latest film is The Dust Bowl. And one thing that your film really illuminated for me was this was not always a dust bowl. These were some of the most verdant, crop-rich, this was part of the real breadbasket of America. Why don't you give us an idea of the wheat glut building up to the Dust Bowl, if you can?
Well, actually, the Southern Plains, because of its arid character, is not suitable for agriculture. It's grassland. And those grasses are, for the most part, short buffalo grasses that sent their roots down 5 feet to suck up whatever moisture they could find, but also to hold the soil in there. So what happened was, is there was been some limited homesteading there, and then later the government enlarged the Homestead Act, and homesteading was encouraged in that area, and it happened to coincide with World War I and a relatively wet period, and so people were getting bumper crops. The United States government was supporting the wheat prices, guaranteeing $2 a bushel, and people began to make money, and more farmers flooded in, and they had more wetter years, and they were great years, and they had incredible crops. But inevitably, the hot weather returned. A drought returned in the 1930s that affected 46 of the 48 states, but nowhere more ferocious and tenacious than in an area formerly known as no man's land, because no one thought anyone would live there, the panhandle of Oklahoma, the panhandle of Texas, and parts of Kansas and Colorado and New Mexico, that became the geological heart of the Dust Bowl, that just blew. And so it's not so much that it was prime agriculture land, it's just that a good deal of the country was suffering drought, a good deal of the country had dust storms, but the very ferocious ones, the worst of them, were down in the Southern Plains, where now in retrospect, perhaps we shouldn't have turned that soil over at all. But when there was wetness, they could produce some pretty spectacular wheat crops, and did for a while, and added to the glut. We turned over an area of grasslands larger than the size of the state of Ohio in that area. And
is this in the Great Plow-Up?
This is in the Great Plow-Up.
This was World War I, right?
World War I through the end of the 20s was the Great Plow-Up. And then when that hard weather came back, that land was exposed and began to blow.
I mean, the most basic lesson was be humble. Respect the land itself. listen to what it's trying to tell you. If the wind blows 60, 70 miles an hour for 50% of the year, there's a reason why only one thing is growing there, and it's native grass. Don't try to put things in place there that don't belong there. Listen to the land itself.
From a policy standpoint, wheat gluts are still occurring on an annual basis around the world. What kind of lessons do you think we could have learned better, and what worked and what didn't work during to get us out of the Dust Bowl?
Well, I think the first and foremost lesson has less to do with wheat than to just the human folly to go in there and plant it. Yes, we do have wheat gluts. We did have wheat gluts then. We sometimes have wheat gluts now in various places. But we also have, because of drought, tremendous shortages. And the real problem facing the human race is that we're going to run out of stuff. And we have to figure out how to plan long term, which we're not very good at doing. We want to live in the moment. A good deal of the agriculture in the United States has been taken over by agribusiness. They're more interested in, you know, the judging me quarter to quarter, the shareholder value, and making profits, than they are with what is harming the environment, what chemicals may be detrimental, what genetically modified foods might be ultimately harmful, and not just expedient in the long term. So I think what we need is a much more organic relationship to the landscape, and much more sustainable, so that we can make sure that our children and our grandchildren have enough to eat, enough to drink, and air that has a quality that's worth breathing.
I remember hearing that always more production is the answer to the problem back then.
It's a kind of completely understandable thing when you think about it, but when you think about it, you also go, uh-oh. When you have a good year, you plant more. When you have a bad year, farm-wise, you plant more to try to make up for what you didn't get the previous year. And what happened was, in the Southern Plains, is that meant you were just exposing more and more and more grassland to turning it over and then being susceptible to the drought and the wind.
And we think of that as isolated with crops, but it's a domino effect with water. And now with our modern systems to petroleum-based fertilizers, and it's not as simple as just putting a seed in the ground and letting it rain like it may have been in the 20s.
Yeah, it was said that during those good years, you could just throw some of this turkey red wheat into the ground and it would just grow, and you'd have a crop and you could sell it at market, and the prices were high, and that was terrific. And even when the government stopped supporting wheat at $2 a bushel, people were making money at a dollar a bushel. But when it collapses to 19 cents and there's no market for it anyway, you're in big trouble. And if that coincides with a drought and the wind starts blowing your topsoil off, you're in a whole world of hurt.
You go broke gradually. You know, it doesn't happen like jumping off of a cliff. You exhaust your savings, you exhaust your borrowings, you exhaust your equipment, you exhaust yourself, and you give up. That takes about 5 years. Then you're starting to look at the wolves.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with filmmaker Ken Burns. His latest film is The Dust Bowl. I've always heard of the Dust Bowl, but we don't think of this country as one that would have sandstorms. That's something out of Lawrence of Arabia or the Sahara Desert. Talk about this two-headed monster that was hitting these people so hard, both the dust and the sand.
Well, it was terrible. There were several different kinds of storms, one that would pick up the sort of coarser sand-like particles and blow them at more or less ground level. I was just back in the area of the Dust Bowl last April and ran across several mini little sandstorms. But it was the big, huge weather systems, the fine particles that got into people's lungs and caused dust pneumonia, but would rise up 7,000 or 8,000 feet, the historian Donald Wolster told us, and sometimes would be 250 miles wide. So you're talking about something that's over a mile high coming at you, a moving mountain range. Tim Egan, the writer of the excellent book The Worst Hard Time, told us. It must have been unimaginably frightening. Just looking at the photographs, looking at the rare footage that we've discovered for this film, it's terrifying just to see it, and that's safely decades away. But then, you know, on our news in 2011, there was a dust storm over Phoenix in living color, and then there was one in Amarillo this summer, and more big spectacular ones. And I think given the ongoing drought right now, we're going to see more of them. And unless we figure out some way to protect this topsoil, we're going to have more and more dust storms, particularly as climate change significantly alters the weather patterns of the world.
Tim Egan spoke of the Dust Bowl as a classic tale of human beings pushing nature too hard and nature pushing back, trying to defy gravity. And he asks, what kind of place was this where children couldn't go outside? And then Douglas Worster also said that these plains can lay a claim for your affection. As I saw this devastation occurring watching the film, one can't help but think, why would they want to live there? And that was one of the big questions. And you have, I can't remember the name of the person, but said, we wanted to come back because it was our home. And I think any viewer is asking, why?
Well, because I think home is always home. And that means it's the associations. It's the place that you know. The plains can be very, very beautiful when the temperatures are moderate and when there's ample rainfall. It's an extremely gorgeous place. It's flat and it's unrelenting. It's not for everybody, but the folks who settled there, it was their home. And just as we, you know, see our home and everything good about it, you'd think they would have left after the second or third storm, particularly when it started killing their children. But a lot of them just tried to make a go of it. Farmers are gamblers, and the farmers in that area were called next year people. They were always certain that no matter how bad it was, it would be better next year. And the very sad tragedy of the Dust Bowl is that not only did it coincide with the Depression, but it didn't get better for 10 years. And it was just year after year of horrible, horrible things. And you never really knew for some folks when to go. 25% left, but 75% stayed in that area.
I think the woman who said it, now I remember, she went to Arkansas with her family, and things became, all of a sudden, the chickens had to step higher to get over the grass, and it sounded like paradise to these kids. But she says, we knew we were going to go back.
And when we got down there, we had a green grass lawn. We kids laughed at chickens because they would raise their legs up so high they were not used to that grass. But we wanted to come back. This was our home out here. We wanted to come back.
Yeah, that's Dorothy Kleffman, and she really fell. She's the one who said that if you wear out a pair of boots in the prairie, you'll stay. And she had been sent back for her health and to find other work when she was a little girl to relatives back in Arkansas. And yeah, it was a lot lusher there. But she yearned for this brown world that she had known and grown up with.
It says something about human spirit in both to be admired, but also in a stubbornness of humankind.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think there's a lot of human folly in this, a lot of human stubbornness, a lot of human perseverance. Let's remember there are cultures living in almost every environment in this globe of ours, in the most inhospitably hot deserts. We can think of the Bushmen of the Kalahari and the Berbers that wander the Sahara Desert. You can think of the various native peoples around the polar, the North Pole, the Aleuts and the Eskimos, the Inuits and other tribes. They make a go of it, and it's what they know. And so a lot of this is just what these folks know. And what they knew then was this world. And for them, you know, the hardships were part of it. But I don't think anybody was prepared for the nature of it. But in retrospect, you would have said, if you knew this was 10 years, would you have stayed? I think most people would have said no. But after a while, that stubbornness comes in, and maybe you're in year 7, and you think it's just got to get better. And some people do leave, but a lot of people stayed.
I want to talk about the making of the film a little bit. Either you and your colleagues who you're interviewing these people who are going to die pretty soon. We're all going to die. But these people it's almost like they're giving their last will and testament.
One of our characters who did die asked to be buried with his complete interview. It had been such a boon for him at the end of his life. He'd lost his wife and was sort of beginning to decline. And here we came knocking on his door, asking him questions about this important time in his life. And he began to understand how important it was. And it sort of revived his spirits for a while. And when he did pass away, we had given him the gift of importance in a way that he hadn't felt in a while. But he gave us a much greater gift, which was his memories. And that's where we were after, you know. We worked really hard to try to find those folks. I advertised on local PBS stations throughout that five-state region and in the Central Valley of California, where some of them left and fled to. And our co-producer, Julie Dunphy, and our associate producer, Susan Schumacher, would go down and hold Dust Bowl roundtables at old age homes and assisted living facilities and historical societies, tiny county historical societies, till we identified, you know, 29 folks that we would interview on film. And Dayton Duncan, the co-producer and co-writer and writer of the series, did. And then, you know, 26 of them, I think, survive in the film, which is a real testament. You never have a shooting ratio that high of folks used to folks shot. It has to do with the gift of their memory that they gave us.
You're probably getting better at the preparation behind this and finding out who's going to be a compelling story to tell as well, since you've been able to do this through
I conducted years. My first interview in January of 1971. That is 41, almost 42 years ago. I still feel like an amateur. One of the hardest things we do is to do an interview with someone. You don't know what you're going to get. We're not trying to pre-program. We're not trying to get them to repeat what they say. We're trying to learn one of the most difficult things it is for human beings to do, which is to listen. You may have a set of questions, but you have to listen really hard so that after question three, maybe you have three A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. And that's what I perpetually feel like in an interview situation. I still feel like I'm a student, just as I was 41 years ago, nearly 42 years ago, as a student at college, sitting down with my first interviewee and have my heart pounding and not knowing what to do. And I've learned, and I'm getting good at it, but it'll probably take my whole lifetime to get good at it.
Well, I can't help but think that the friends and loved ones who you interview are very thankful for that treasure.
Well, you know, it's rings. It's just the way we have with friendship. People close to them will, of course, know them intimately and personally, and these interviews will have real meaning. But I think in a larger sense, the rest of us are even more generously bestowed by their willingness to talk about these tough times, because then we are now, in the shape of this film and other films that are made about similar things, we're now charged with the responsibility of how we save our planet. And these people are warning us about certain things, and if we don't listen to them, then we've missed the great gift of their reflections, their memories that they so generously shared with us.
Well, you've given us a gift as well in the historical treasures that you've created through the years. And the latest is the Dust Bowl. It premieres on PBS November 18th and 19th. Filmmaker Ken Burns, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jay Unger and Woody Guthrie.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.